Hello and welcome to Conquest Corner. Today I have the privilege of speaking with Colin Lloyd. Colin started working in the city back in 1987. He has a vast experience covering commodities, derivatives, bonds, etc. Currently working as a freelance consultant with Linear Investments. Good morning, Colin. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Peter. And it's great to be on the program.
Thank you ever so much for joining me, Colin. I know you're very busy, so thank you for sharing your time with me today. Now, Colin, what I wanted to do is to start with yourself, just giving us a little bit of background on your, on where you started, where you were as a young man, maybe going that far back, your studies, and what led you to the city and the interests you currently have today.
Well, thank you. I guess the first thing I should tell the your listeners is I'm, whether you can tell it or not, originally from Liverpool. I started my career actually working up there in the physical commodity markets, a family business. We were what was known as a Delcredery agent, for want of a better phrase, a broker between producers and importers. All around the world. And this gave me a phenomenal kind of experience and background in the real traded side of the commodity business. And it was that, after 6 or 7 years, that led me to want to get involved in the more efficient world of exchange traded derivative products and things financial. So in 1987, I came to the city and joined a commodity exchange-traded derivatives broker called GNI, which is a subsidiary of Gerrard and National, the discount house. Discount houses traditionally discounted trade bills and also bills on behalf of the Bank of England. Latterly, the trade bills all disappeared, and discounting and acting as the intermediary with the Bank of England was a very important role in those days. And when the futures markets started to get involved in financials, that was when Gerrard moved into the financial futures arena with the gilt futures and the short-term interest rate future on sterling deposit rates. I was very lucky. I joined the business just as it was really starting to take off, actually after the crash of 87, and got involved working with global macro hedge funds almost from the outset. It was that was kind of my first love, and you know, latterly that's what's brought me back to writing a macroeconomic newsletter. But I had a really broad career there. From 87 through until 1999, I was concentrating on global macro, and then the opportunity to get involved with our fledgling institutional side of our CFD business gave me the opportunity to switch over to equities and to quantitative and systematic type clients. We move on to 2006, and I did a complete about change. GNI had been bought by, or Gerrard's had been bought by Old Mutual, and GNI got sold to Man Group. And after 3 years with Man Group, it kind of came to the end of its useful time together, and I moved on to work for a quantitative macro hedge fund and flipped from the sell side to the buy side, concentrating on investor relations, which allowed me to really understand the institutional side of the investment world at the kind of the cutting edge, if you like. I did that for about 4 years, then started a kind of consulting business helping startup hedge funds to really manage their the challenge of building distribution and marketing and how they could promote given the limitations that hedge funds have. And then did a complete about face again and got involved with a foreign exchange liquidity business, which we put into a joint venture with Mako Group, the derivatives market-making firm. That business was sold in 2014, but since around 2013, I've been writing a macroeconomic newsletter. I did spent a little time working with another hedge fund for the last year and a half, that's now come to its end. And I am doing regular TV appearances for Linear Talk, part of Linear Investments. So that's a bit of a tour de force of what I've been up to for the last 30 years.
No, thank you ever so much for sharing that, Colin. I wanted to go back a little bit. I'm going to cover some of the points that you've made. I wanted to talk about first your education in Liverpool. Did you go to uni? What did you study there?
Okay, so I grew up on the Wirral, just south of Liverpool. Yeah. I went to a local prep school and then on to a boarding school in Shropshire. After that, I wanted to go into my family business. I wanted to be in sales, marketing, and so forth. But a rather long conversation with my father led me to rush off and do the shortest business course I could find, which was 2 years at the Salford College of Higher Technology, which is down the road from Salford University. I specialized in marketing and advertising there and then went into our family firm, got the sort of background there, did a course in wood science because that was part of what we were involved with, and then did the switch to come and work in the city.
So the family firm, what exactly did it do, Colin?
Okay, so we acted as the agent for producers of tropical hardwoods. We worked with one company, which was kind of fascinating, who had a concession in North Borneo. I actually worked out there for about the best part of a year. Aside from clearing tropical rainforest, which might sound a little heinous, they also had for many years the Guinness Book of Records record for the fastest growing tropical replantation timbers. they could grow a tree to 135 feet in 5 years. Wow. When you consider that it takes about six times yeah. that long to grow a tree in Scotland to the same kind of level.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, now, you've in your own words, you've covered a vast amount of different topics prior to 87 coming to the city and current day, but there's a theme running through that in a sense of you are very very focused on analysing whether it be commodities or hedge funds or efficient markets. However, you seem to be traversing different. Different sectors at the same time over that 30 years, and I'm asking really, have you found your niche now given the length of time you've been working in across different sectors?
I think my sort of evolution as an investor has really been it was governed by one's always governed by one's own experience. So the problem with most physical commodity markets is that they're opaque and inefficient. The advantage of exchange traded markets is you have price discovery, you have liquidity, you have contracts which are clearly defined in terms of quality, quantity, and so forth. Somewhere between the two is usually the sweet spot where things are most profitable. The other thing that really struck me, having been in a commodity business first, is whilst we owe a great debt of gratitude to Harry Markowitz and his ideas for the modern portfolio, diversified across different asset classes, in actual fact, the secret of successful investing in quantitative terms is timing. If you get your timing wrong, it doesn't matter how right you might be. You might not have, what was it Keynes said? The markets can remain irrational longer than I can remain solvent.
Indeed.
So I guess first thing I'd say is I'm not a bottom-up stock picker. I tend to look at things from the sort of the 30,000-foot global macro view first. So I'm thinking about which currencies are going to do well. Then I'm thinking about, well, within those currencies, you know, which particular country or region is likely to do well. Then I'm thinking about whether that's best expressed through through stocks in general. So I'd probably look at indices or ETFs, or in the government bonds, or maybe in the corporate bond market. I'll also think about, you know, the valuations and the yield on real estate as an alternative. And I think of the hedge funds as not really being, you know, a separate asset class. They're a range of wide range of different strategies for achieving you know, a better risk adjusted return, which of course that means different things to different people. But for me, you can diversify by asset, or you can diversify by strategy.
Okay, so you spoke of your evolution as an investor. How long have you been investing or trading in stocks and shares? And do you remember the first investment or purchase that you made independently yourself?
I think the very first investment I made was in a Fidelity Unit Trust, which was investing in China. And that was back, I guess I was 20, 22 years old, something like that. I got terribly excited, watched the price every day. And then when it dropped about 20%, scared the living daylights out of me. Yeah. I hit a bid and got a rather smaller check back. And kind of learnt my first lesson, which is don't be too myopically focused on every day's price move if you're taking a long-term investment. So
indeed,
the first thing you need to do is to be comfortable with the time horizon you're taking, and remember that you need to be able to weather quite a large loss in order to make a sensible long-term return.
Absolutely. Now, given your family were into hardwood and tropical wood, etc., who was the person in your family that gave you an introduction or an insight into what investing was about?
Well, actually, it was really more from my mother's side of the family. My maternal grandfather was a partner at Rensburgs in the 1930s, the Liverpool-based stockbroker.
Yeah.
So I guess you might think it was in my blood, but really, my grandfather's motto on that side of the family was never spend the capital. So to that extent, I picked it up because my mother had a range of different investments and managed her, you know, a variety of building society accounts and some gilts and things like that. So I picked it up from that. And then it was in those Thatcher years, the privatizations. I remember the British Gas privatization, which I think that was in 1986. And the advert on the television was, you know, don't forget to tell Sid. Well,
yes.
I guess I was one of the millions of Sids. So that was kind of a pleasing experience because the price went up and one always felt comfortable about that. I can't remember if I sold the stock at a profit or not. I hope I did, but at least I didn't look at it too myopically.
So British Gas was your first stock purchase, I'm taking it, yeah?
I think so, yes. Okay. That's certainly my recollection.
Okay, so you said earlier that what really got you interested in the investments side of things was your experience in the commodities business, yeah? So when you arrived in 87 to work at the futures broking discount subsidiary, Gerard & National, now, what was it about that experience that then led on from there?
Well, I'd been interested in the financial markets and I'd quickly come to realise that there was more to the world than just stocks and shares. And so joining a financial futures firm really meant a focus, particularly in the institutional side of the business, on the interest rate markets. So I got involved in the sort of the cutting edge of the money markets. I got involved in options strategies and things like that. And back in those days, providing you disclosed what you were doing to your compliance officer, you were allowed to have personal trading accounts. And I cut my teeth trying to do various arbitrage strategies in interest rates and commodity markets and that kind of thing. Sometimes successfully, sometimes not. What I did learn along the way was a lot about the risks involved with leveraged investments and how quickly things can turn around. You know, the expression that many arbitrage strategies are like picking up nickels in front of a steamroller is incredibly true. And I certainly got caught out on a number of occasions by virtue of, you know, making gradual profits over several months, only to see them given back in a matter of days.
Indeed, I think I've not heard that that quote before regarding the steamroller and the nickels, but one of my favourites is Charlie Munger's quote regarding risk and volatility, and it's remarkable how much long term advantage people like us have gotten by trying to be to be consistently not stupid instead of trying to be very intelligent.
Yes, but I guess another thing that I really I think it's very important for people who are investing to understand that the real key to successful investing is the discipline that you have once you've put your position on. Whether it's a short-term trade or a long-term trade doesn't really matter. I mean, people say, oh, is this a trading position or an investment position? Well, I think they're one continuum. You know, high-frequency traders invest for milliseconds. Warren Buffett invests forever.
Yeah,
it should be that at bottom the same process. You know what your investment is, whether it's driven fundamentally or technically, or a combination of both. But you know how much you're prepared to lose. You have analyzed what is a reasonable amount of wiggle room, if you like, the amount of volatility that you should be prepared to accept in order to make your return. And then you need to have a process for trying to take those profits when you can, and to, most importantly, more importantly, cut your losses to make sure that you still have enough to play with the next time you want to invest.
Absolutely. So given that, what do you think are the great advantages of stocks and exchange-traded derivatives, Colin?
When you look at stocks, there's various different ways of assessing their riskiness and so forth. A highly leveraged stock, where there's a very substantial amount of debt on the balance sheet, is likely to have a pretty high beta. That is, it's a measure of its volatility relative to the underlying stock index. That may be a more risky investment than investing in FTSE futures if the stock is really highly geared. And I think people tend to forget what leverage is and where it can come from. The important thing to understand if you're moving away from single stocks or that kind of instrument towards derivatives is that with derivatives you can lose more than your initial investment, and that's a crucial element of what anybody investing in derivatives should understand first and foremost.
Okay, thank you for that response, Colin. So as an investor, how would you, given all your experience, how would you currently describe yourself in a sense of whether it's low risk, cautious, long term? How would you describe your investment strategy?
I write a macro newsletter called In the Long Run,
yeah,
and that pretty much describes my approach to things. I'm probably, you know, a broker's worst client, because if I can, I don't want to adjust my investment at all. What I try to do is to make sure that I balance things out. I'm quite cautious, so I'm invested pretty much exclusively in stocks and hedge funds, which hopefully give me the diversification that I need. Now, that might sound strange, because you're supposed to invest in bonds if you're cautious. My problem is that I don't think most bond markets are offering a real positive expected return with yields where they are currently. Now, I missed quite a large part of the move in the last few years, as bond yields in many countries, government bond yields, actually went negative. It's kind of absurd. And so the capital appreciation was great. I'm the first to admit I got that wrong. But I was uncomfortable owning bonds with yields of, say, 1 or 2% when inflation was running at 2 or 3%. And my inflation is certainly running a little higher than that. I'm sure many people listening to this program know that RPI is a pale shadow of what it really costs them each year, year by year. And what I try to do is I try to have offsetting strategies. I worked for a trend following managed futures fund. What they do is they have technical systems for trading all manner of different asset classes using a timing system. Using that kind of strategy, you simply look at the technicals. Many's the time that I've identified a trade which makes money from a technical point of view as well, but often as not, in my fundamental analysis, I will have missed several of the trades which were out there. So the advantage of a systematic approach, I think, is definitely worth considering. But I also like, you know, the global macro approach that managers take. So I have some investments there, and then the rest is diversified. It probably looks a little bit like the MSCI World Index, because I've got maybe 40% of my stock positions in index tracking funds in the US, another slug in Europe, a further slug of Asia Pacific ex Japan. I'm never quite sure what to do with Japan. Technically, I think it looks very interesting right now, but again, by being invested in a managed futures fund which has exposures, you know, as and when to the Nikkei 225, I've kind of got that base covered, so I don't have to think about it. And I quite like the idea of not being myopically focused on the markets. And I learned that by being myopically focused on the markets for many, many years as futures broker.
Good point. So, I mean, I've got to touch on Japan with you, because you've raised it. I mean, it appears that everyone, every fund manager out there, every analyst out there, has been calling Japan for the past 20 years, in a sense of it's arrived, it's not arrived, it's going to go down further, it's going to go, this is its time in the sun. What's your current thinking regarding Japan, Colin?
Current thinking about Japan is the Bank of Japan have moved to what they called yield curve control. Now, that's a fancy way of saying unlimited QE. They're going to keep the 10-year JGB at or close to 0%. I noticed actually last month there was a little blip on the, I think it was the 3rd of February, when the yield popped up to 15 basis points for a couple of hours and came back down to 10 basis points very quickly. I suspect their mettle is going to be tested at some point by the markets. Whenever someone tries to fix the price of something, it generally does. Yeah. But if the Bank of Japan continue to expand their balance sheet, they will finally lead the world to realize that it is de jure, de facto debasement of the Japanese yen, and the yen will fall precipitously. At that point, the Nikkei will do extremely well because there are some magnificent companies in the Nikkei 225. The valuation of a lot of the stocks in the Nikkei 225 even now is quite reasonable when compared with other stock markets. The difficulty for investors investing in Japan has been the fact that the yen has been appreciating for, you know, pretty much ever since the end of Bretton Woods. I think back at Bretton Woods, it was 360 to the dollar. It did bottom out recently at 76 to the dollar. That's a massive appreciation. And in the same way, if you look at the Swiss market index, there are world-beating companies there that are based in Switzerland. And they live with the fact that the Swiss franc rises around 2 to 3% a year, every year, monotonously. It's been doing it since I was a child. The SNB tried to stop it for a brief period, and it cost them dearly. But I think that at some point, the yen really will hit the ropes. The Nikkei will do well. So investing in the Nikkei on a hedged basis, well, the easiest way of doing that for me, given my background, is to buy Nikkei 225 futures, because then you're only worrying about the capital appreciation that you can repatriate into dollars or pounds or euros or whatever your base currency is on a monthly or quarterly basis.
Okay, thank you for that reply. It's very broad as well, in a sense of enabling all of our listeners from different levels of understanding to grasp as well.
So, Peter, I was going to say, if you're looking for a technical level, a close above 20,950 is one of the things that I think looks kind of compelling. Technical pattern there. It looks like a double bottom has been put in, and we might see the Nikkei back at the heady heights of 27,000. I think that was last seen back in the 1990s. So,
okay. I
think it's exciting. It's to misquote Saint Augustine, give me the Nikkei, Lord, but not yet.
Yes, I think everyone's been waiting for that to come. It's like wanting it now. So that's good. So Colin, I think you've covered this. However, I will ask, do you have a sector preference in a sense of your long-term view?
Yes, one of the investment mistakes I made for many years was not to be invested in the US stock market on the basis that it always seemed to be more expensive than anywhere else. And I never seemed to be able to find the dip to buy. Trading or working for systematic funds, taught me a number of things, one of which is the idea that there's leaders and laggards, and very often it makes more sense if the first market to break out is wheat followed by corn. Don't bother buying corn because it's the laggard. Buy wheat because it'll go up 100% and corn will only go up 50%. And there's a lot of that kind of analysis. So I guess learnt from that I needed to have something, was fortunate in being able to sell bonds and buy US stocks back in 2010, I think it was, and a bit more in 2011. The mistake, of course, was, had I had an index-linked, long-dated gilt, I'd have done infinitely better than buying U.S. stocks, even with the decline in the value of sterling. But that's another matter. I've had a preference to the U.S. I keep thinking it's expensive and getting sort of psychologically, emotionally nervous about it, but it made a new high on the first day of of the month, I think, or so on the 27th of February.
Yeah.
You know, I remain long the US. Europe has been kind of dragged up on its coattails. Japan looks kind of compelling on the back of that. But there's a very, you know, there's a very, very strong correlation between what the US does and what other world stock markets do in general. And the other worry that I have is a large part of the reason that the US stock market is where it is has been the huge amount of quantitative easing from the world's central banks. You know, the great tenet that you should have, you know, 40% in stocks and 60% in bonds when you're at a retirement age and vice versa when you're 25, which goes back to Harry Markowitz, is all well and good. But what I see is the last 7-8 years, bonds have been the driver, and the driver of bonds has been QE and pretty much zero interest rates everywhere. When that unwinds, you're not going to be able to hide in bonds.
Absolutely not. I mean, what I found very interesting, I think it was only last week, it was declared, was the fact that Apple, which is up more than 40% over the last year, Warren Buffett has put in a significant investment again and added onto his previous investment in there, in that company now. And I was thinking, well, that's quite staggering, saying, you know, that bonds are where they are and that's where the safety play should be. But yet he's adding, even though Apple looks relatively expensive now, given the progress it's made, he's adding to that weighting in Apple of all stocks.
Yeah, it isn't sort of intuitively, you don't think that's a Warren Buffett type of investment.
Absolutely.
Until you read what he says, which is that he thinks Apple has a fabulous brand.
Indeed.
And, you know, they do have a great brand. Yeah. And they concentrate on really targeting their core clients. They do a fabulous marketing job. And that's why, you know, you could buy an iPod for $200, but everybody wants an iPhone for $600, which to me, kind of being parsimonious for a moment, I can buy a perfectly good smartphone and an iPod probably for $300. But there's a convenience, there's a wow factor, there's a sexiness to having the latest iPhone, and my goodness, Apple capitalized on that.
Absolutely. What I find also intriguing, obviously, he's very good friends with Bill Gates, and he likes the Microsoft business. He likes Bill Gates because they're very good chums. However, he's I don't know if he's ever, but he currently has no holdings within Microsoft whatsoever.
That might be an interesting fireside conversation to listen to. Brian, I was looking recently at Berkshire Hathaway's SEC filings because I was trying to remember what price it was Buffett bought Coca-Cola at. And, you know, he's never sold a share since he bought it back in the aftermath of the stock market crash in 1988.
Mm. Yeah.
Although he, you know, he did start buying at $3.20 and bought it all the way down to, I think it was about $2.50. So
yeah,
I'd have been pretty uncomfortable buying on that much of a pullback, but that's because that's not my style of investing.
Well, I'm the sort of person, I'm a contrarian, Colin, so I tend not to be able to get my timing right regarding certain stocks. So I tend to scale in sometimes or most of the time, and equally I scale out when I think a stock has reached or has gotten to the point of it being overvalued. So yeah, it's very, very difficult sometimes to find the right stock and get it at the right price, because you could be waiting around for a long time.
Yeah, I don't tend to play the contrarian trade. It doesn't sit comfortably with my way of investing. So I tend to wait for the market to, you know, I mean, like the Nikkei. If I was the contrarian, I'd have been long for quite a long time. But my goodness, there have been a number of times that I've been shaken out on
Absolutely.
The way down
yes.
the past
yeah.
year. What I tend to prefer is to buy it when it's going back up. Once I feel the bottom's been reached, I get in and I'm prepared for the fact that I'm never going to pick the bottom and I'm never going to sell the top. I get in as the market rises, I get out as it starts to decline again. And then you can take that to the sort of the next stage and say, well, if markets simply rise and fall, why don't you have just a simple strategy that makes you long when the markets are going up and gets you short when the markets are going down, and then you have twice as much bang for your buck.
Sadly,
it's not quite as simple as that. Markets fall three times as quickly as they rise on average, and that combined with the significant pickup and volatility that you get make it much more difficult to trade to the short side. But in principle, the idea is there. I guess that's one of my guiding principles, which again comes from the fact that I started my life in the commodity markets.
Okay, thank you for that, Colin. Now you've almost covered the question, but I will ask it anyway. What are your essential criteria when researching companies that lead to you pushing that buy button, Colin?
Again, I sort of start from the top down. Last week, I wrote a piece about the NATO budget. I thought it was an interesting one because of the way Donald Trump has been carrying on since his election. The Europeans need to honour their commitments going back to 2006 and spend a lot more on defence. Obviously, given their rather straitened circumstances and tight budgets, they're all wriggling to try and get out of those commitments. But I think the new US administration is going to be rather more insistent than Obama was. I don't actually think it makes a lot of difference to the bond markets. If Germany, France, Italy, Spain spend $64 billion a year more on defence to bring them up to the 2% target, 2% of GDP, that is, for each country. That's what they all signed up to in 2006. Then there's going to be government bond issuance, but the ECB are buying 60 to 80 billion. Well, I think they're dropping down to 60 billion from April a month. Another 64 billion over the course of the year is neither here nor there. So I don't think the bond markets are going to suffer very much. But given that the Americans are now proposing to buy American, I suspect that the Europeans will buy European, and therefore European defense stocks probably look rather good. Added to which, the US have already announced increases in spending. Now, admittedly, that'll affect the US defense companies first, but it should filter down not only to US defense contractors, but also to European defense contractors who are world leading in their class. So I use this as an example. So that's my kind of top down approach. So I still like equities over bonds. I still think that QE is going to carry on in Europe. I think it's probably being tapered away in the US, but little by little. I think all the central banks are going to allow a bit more inflation because every time they try to snub it out, they snub out the recovery as well. And therefore, I like stocks. So what areas of the stock market offer value? Well, I like the defense story because of the fundamentals. They don't look particularly expensive. I mean, the US defense stocks have done better. So in relative terms, Europe looks cheaper. I've just said I like leaders rather than laggards, so I'm contradicting myself straight away. But I think there's a compelling case over the next 10 to 15 years for buying defense stocks in Europe. That's a live example of the kind of thought process. Another thing is I like emerging markets. They've done rather badly over the last few years. American protectionism is probably likely to be detrimental, but I think that India is now the strongest growth economy. It's got a huge internal market. It's got a competitive advantage over China. Vietnam, has a competitive advantage for primary, untechnical goods. So I think Vietnam offers opportunities. And again, I'm looking from the top down and saying, you know, I like this. I like Vietnam's geographic proximity to China. I like India's advantage in terms of education, in terms of, whilst they speak many languages, they all, to a lesser or greater extent, speak English, and that's the language of commerce there. So they've got significant advantages. I'm not disputing the fact that there are a number of disadvantages with India in particular and emerging markets in general, because they're at that stage of their development. But again, that process starts with, where are those competitive advantages? I read an article only this morning saying, Chinese manufacturing costs are now only 4% less than they are in the United States. And therefore, they're moving steadily up and up the complexity chain in terms of the goods that they're manufacturing. This is a complete sort of repeat of what Japan did in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s.
Absolutely. I was going to just ask you in the middle of that, Colin, regarding your criteria, in a sense of what's been happening, obviously, with the markets, as you touched on earlier, is that ETFs have impacted what level of stocks are being bought. High frequency trading has impacted that. Brexit has impacted that. The Trump's being elected has impacted that. So I was just going to encompass that and ask you, with regards to being a long-term investor, how do you ignore all of that noise and just pick a theme or be thematic, in the sense of, you're saying militarization stocks, and it has been a bit of a sector to have been invested in for the past 25 years, will continue to be an area to invest in. And also the fact that European and UK defence stocks are grossly undervalued in comparison to US stocks. So I'm just thinking, regarding theme, how do you take all of that out of the noise?
If European and UK defence stocks have been grossly undervalued relative to the US for the last 25 years.
Not for the last 25 years, but they've been outperformed by the US stocks, but now they're grossly undervalued in comparison to the US, their US peers, primarily because, if you look at Rolls-Royce, Cobham, Meggitt, they've all had profit warnings over the last 3 or 4 years, consistently poor.
Defence spending as a percentage of GDP for all the members of NATO has been steadily declining over the last 30, 40 years, obviously since the fall of the Berlin Wall. And yet defence stocks, given the size of investment, have done pretty well, because they're really in the technology business first and foremost.
Yes.
And the fact that European stocks are cheap relative to US stocks is probably, to a large extent, structural. US spends more on defense. They will more likely spend that with US defense companies. And therefore, those companies probably have an advantage in terms of their home market. That doesn't mean that there won't be waxing and waning of the relationship between the two. And at the moment, I think there's more pressure on Europe to spend more on defense than there has been in generations. And that, to me, is a compelling fundamental. In terms of how I'd play it from here, I'd be watching it from a technical perspective. As you pointed out, there's been profit warnings and so forth. Things will turn around on a stock-specific basis. I, again, don't tend to drill down that far, but there is an ETF which gives you exposure to European defense. If you want to play something really funky, you might be able to short the US defense ETF and buy the European one. But again, I haven't looked at it. there's a world of issues connected with shorting stocks anyway.
And the
rumours are that Donald and his merry men are going to increase spending on defence by between 500 billion and a trillion over the course of their administration. It doesn't look as if it's going to be that big on the basis of what we saw last week. But nonetheless, would you be shorting U.S. defense stocks into a buying spree by the Pentagon? Probably not.
Yes. No. So given all of that, Colin, and you're starting in a city back in 87, what has been your greatest lesson that you've attained since you started investing?
Greatest lesson. Probably the greatest lesson is about the risk that you should be taking on an investment. What tends to stop people succeeding in their investments is that they aren't prepared to take enough downside risk. So let's say that the volatility of a market is 20% on an annualized basis. Well, that probably means that to me, you should have your stop loss when you make your investment about 40% away from the market. Now, that sounds like a lot, but if you have it just 20% of the away from the price that you buy, let's say you buy at a pound and you put your stop loss at 80p, the chances are during the course of the next 12 months, you will get stopped out, or just about. You need to give your investment more room for maneuver. The pundits tell you that a bear market starts is at when you're down 20% or 30%. I always forget what the definition of a bear market is. I take a view. I mean, take the 2008-2009 period. I had my view of how much of a correction I thought would be the point at which I would start to feel that stocks were no longer the place to be. And it was around about 60% below the market back in early 2008. So I didn't get shaken out. Now, you could argue that that's a ridiculous amount of risk to take. But if you are taking a long-term investment approach, you ought to be thinking about the dividends that you're earning and compounding them rather than just looking at the index. And you should take the view that, if there's a 60% correction, it's a buying opportunity. If it goes further than that, it may be to do with the structural shift in the world economy, and you ought to be rethinking on the basis of that. Now, you might argue that with all the quantitative easing and zero interest rates that we've seen and the very anemic growth rates that we've seen since 2008, that there has been a seismic shift. But my goodness, I'm glad I didn't stop myself out at down 60% in 2009 or whatever it was. Not quite down that far, but it wasn't far off in places. Only to see the markets making new highs within 8-9 years because of quantitative easing and zero interest rate policy from central bankers who are determined to save the planet.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very, very good point you've made there, Colin. And equally, just if you look at some of the individual stocks that got absolutely, thrown out with the bathwater on the day of the Brexit vote, especially house builders, etc., that were down 30-40%, and majority of them have now rebounded in the past 6 months back to the pre-Brexit sort of pricing. So yeah, sometimes it's better to, like you say, have a very long-term view and maintain your portfolio rather than be panicked out.
There are two factors that I think one ought to also think about. The way markets trade today is very different to the way they traded 10, 20, 30 years ago. part of that is the technology, you know, access to the markets. People can sit at home and buy and sell shares on their computers and so forth. But also the amount of capital invested by the liquidity providers, the market makers in those stocks, has been vastly reduced relative to where it was. I remember about back in the mid 1990s, I had the privilege to meet a chap called Glenn Foster, who had been a specialist on the New York Stock Exchange from around about 1947. And he said that by 1990, he reckoned that the amount of capital deployed by the specialists on the New York Stock Exchange was about one fifth of what it had been when he'd started in the business. Now, that's partly a function of the vast increase in stock prices, but it's also a factor of, you know, people using less and less capital. Well, if you're using less and less capital to support the same activity, your stop losses have to be that much closer. And so when markets gap, as they did on Brexit, or as Sterling did during its little mini flash crash during New Zealand trading hours a couple of months ago, it can move by, you know, instruments can move by enormous amounts.
Yeah.
And during the process, if you've got your stop losses in the market, you will be stopped out at exactly the wrong place. And that is the nature of the way markets are likely to trade. I was just looking at the VIX. The VIX is trading at 12.2%, which is right at the bottom of its recent range, which is not, you know, this is over the last 5 years. And that's not a big surprise, because the US, the S&P is making new all-time highs.
Yeah.
And tends to be like that. But the spike that we saw back during the Trump election is a reflection of how quickly those prices can get, or the price of the level of volatility can increase. And I think that's just going to become more prevalent. And therefore, your risk management approach needs to take account of the fact that liquidity will be there when you don't need it.
Yes.
It won't be there when you do. Mm-hmm. And that was the case when I joined the Citi back in the 1980s. It's about 10 times more so now.
Yeah, I mean, that whipsawing effect obviously creates lots of churn and anxiety, and you know, especially with currencies, as we've seen in the past, and bonds. But my concern with that is that, you know, as what happened with the Swiss franc previously, is that companies, entities, individuals, some of them who are highly leveraged will get completely wiped out. And that's going to continue to happen, unfortunately.
There is absolutely that chance. The other thing is that, you know, with interest rates where they are, there's a huge, overwhelming incentive to issue debt rather than equity. And so, you know, part of the rally we've seen in the stock market since 2008-09, the low, I think, in March 09, has been driven by continuous share buybacks. In the old days, if the C-suite went out and bought back their shares after, you know, three, maybe four quarters, they'd have the shareholders questioning their imagination, because they weren't making capital investments, and, you know, it was a rather feeble thing to buy back your stock. But in the current environment, where interest rates are artificially low, the quantitative easing programs have been going on for years, it probably makes fiduciary sense on the part of the C-suite to buy back stock, because if they use the current discounting factors to work out the value of a new project, then it looks profitable. But, you know, interest rates go back up 400-500 basis points to where they should be, it doesn't look profitable. And the sucking sound of the tide going out if interest rates go back up by 400-500 basis points is going to be huge. So
yeah,
you can see why share buybacks are occurring, but it also happens to really suit those members of the C-suite who have a large number of stock options. So things are very artificial in this current environment, but they have been probably throughout my entire time in the city. They're just more so now than they were then. So a little bit like what I said about those defense stocks earlier. Structurally, US defense stocks are probably going to trade at a higher multiple than their European counterparts. And you're trying to say, well, you know, what would be the right price for this stock if interest rates were at a real level? Well, they haven't been at a real level for years. I did write a long piece for the Cobden Center about how interest rates, or central bank interest rates, have been at the wrong price ever since the Bank of England was founded in 1694. But that's another story.
No, we might have to discuss that another time, Colin. I'm conscious that I've had you on this line for a little while. I was going to ask you, given the many lessons, and you've touched on this almost already, but given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, which one would you most wish to share with our audience and listeners, please?
I think it's that lesson about managing your risk.
Okay.
There are lots and lots of great investment ideas that come up every day. Some of them will work, some of them won't, because you know investing is all about timing. When you make an investment, you can do it as a sophisticated, diversified portfolio and therefore not have specific stop losses. But I would argue that that's probably a dangerous thing to do when all asset classes are so much more correlated today. But it's about having a sensible amount of risk. And if you're having to put your stop loss too close to the market because of the investment you want to make, halve the amount of the investment you want to make and have your stop loss far enough away from the market. It means that you're still holding some stuff, you know, some of your capital in cash waiting to make your next investment, but better that than being stopped out at the wrong price because you wanted to make a full investment. And some people have price targets. Others use a kind of momentum strategy. I tend to use that because you never know how far a trend is going to continue. You know, in the same way as the markets can remain irrational longer than Mr. Keynes could remain solvent, they can remain irrational and keep going up when they should have fallen several years before. Now, you know, people who come from the bond market think the stock market's completely nuts. Then again, they didn't think it was fair value even in 2009, quite a lot of.
Absolutely, yes.
So, yeah, I think that's the biggest point is to manage your risk and manage it sensibly. Make sure you take enough risk. And if you're in terms of the price risk on your investment, to ensure that you're not forced out of your investment. So instead of investing £100, only invest 50. In order to be able to weather sufficient adverse price action, and that way you'll make money.
Very, very good point there, Colin. So to encapsulate that then, what has been your wisest investment decision to date?
I would say it was making the investment in a systematic managed futures fund. And the reason for that is that takes care of the difficult timing decisions that I may need to make. And as that investment becomes a larger part of my portfolio, it obviates the need for me to adjust my stock portfolio. The futures strategy works well in being negatively correlated to falling stock markets in a general sense and non-correlated during other periods. What that means is hopefully it'll make money most of the time. It comes in fits and starts, but you know, so often investments do. But I can hold my stock portfolio knowing that in adverse conditions, my managed futures strategy will put me short stocks because they're starting to go down and they're following their technical signals on each market. But also, there'll probably be long interest rates in those in that environment. They'll have investments in commodities and in currencies as well. So it gives me a very broad array of different asset classes, but it's taking a trading approach, a strategy approach to each of those asset classes, which means that it's not going to correlate with the value, the bonds as an asset class, because it may be long some bonds and short other bonds. But in aggregate, if I keep that and it becomes a larger part of my portfolio relative to my stock portfolio, as I get older and think about retirement, not that I'm going to be able to, it should dampen the volatility of the entire portfolio dynamically.
Yes.
It's a different approach to the modern portfolio idea, which was based on the idea that you could only be long an asset class. It, I think, is a significant improvement on the static approach.
Okay, I wanted to cover, Colin, obviously you're currently working as a freelance consultant with Linear Investments, plus also you publish a fortnightly macro newsletter, which I wanted to quickly talk about. I'm conscious I've had you on the phone for a little while now. I want to touch firstly on your TV presentation you do with Linear. Just expand on that and tell people what it is, where it is, and where they can find it.
Okay, so Linear Investments. I forget the exact link to the media section, but if you go to the Linear Investments website, you'll find a button on the left hand side at the top for media, and Linear Talk is what I present on a fortnightly basis. It's myself and Jerry Lees, who's the CEO of Linear, and the format is a roundup on macro at the beginning of the month and a roundup on hedge fund performance about halfway through the month, plus interviews with a variety of people involved in the alternative investment space. And I've been doing that probably for the last year or so. And then the macro newsletter is in thelongrun.co.uk. And I've been doing that for about 3 years now. And that's quite a in-depth sort of review of different topics that I think sort of stand out. On average, I write about 3,000 words, so it's not your typical blog.
So how did the you won an award for the blog, Colin? How did that come about?
The people at Focus Economics. Focus Economics have been around for about 10-15 years. They collate the forecasts from about 300, I think it's 300, different macroeconomic commentators. All the sort of usual household names, plus many that you may not have heard of, to give a kind of consensus forecast. So that they're looking at commentary from all manner of different walks of life. And they very kindly added me to their top 100 blogs for this year, which came about really quite by accident.
Well, I've read it since we started speaking prior to Christmas. I've been reading a few of the articles that you've done, and it's an extremely high standard. Some of it was an education to me. I was like, oh, right, okay, so my understanding of that is completely wrong. So absolutely very insightful articles you're writing there.
I'll tell you what I would say. In economics, nothing is absolutely completely wrong. It's an incredibly difficult discipline. They try to suggest that economics is a science, and certainly a lot of the study of economics is highly mathematical. There was a lovely story told to me by Eamon Butler from the Adam Smith, who'd been giving a lecture at I think at Bristol University, and a lady came up to him afterwards to thank him for only having put one equation in his presentation. and she said, "It's so refreshing to see that, sir." And he said, "Ah," he said, "are you studying economics?" He said, "Well, actually, I'm doing a joint honours degree in mathematics and economics." She said, "But I have to tell you that there's probably more mathematics in economics than there is in my mathematics course." And I think that's one of the problems. We try to make economics too scientific. There are big picture things that are happening in the world that are kind of self-evident if you think about them, but they don't necessarily show up in the statistics. And that may be to do with mismatches in the timing of things. I've got a little sort of bee in my bonnet about savings and investments. People save, and if they're and they may save in the bank, they may then make an investment at a later stage. Now, what governs their liquidity preference to hold it in the bank and earn nothing on it, or to make an investment in the stock market, or lend it out through a peer-to-peer lending platform or something like that, is very subjective, and it's very much the kind of human interaction. I think it's difficult to try and be clear about that. The other side of the coin is household debt versus investment. When does somebody buy a house? How much of a mortgage do they get? What are the terms? When do they remortgage? And what do they do with these things? And a lot of the statistics show very little cause and effect. And yet we know that if I'm strapped with a massive mortgage and interest rates are likely to rise by 200 basis points over the next 12 months, I'm probably going to stop spending in the supermarket, and I'm probably going to stop spending on the high street. And yet a lot of the statistics just don't show these sort of things. So it's still very much an art rather than a science, and being an art, we get it wrong more often probably than we get it right.
Yeah, there's a brilliant quote I saw many years ago. I think it's from, if I get this right, Danny Roderick. It was in The Globalization Paradox, Democracy and Future of the World Economy. And it goes, the correct answer to almost any question in economics is, it depends. Which, yeah, I thought was absolutely striking at the time. And I still recall that now. It's like, well, I'll give you the answer now, but that depends. I'll give you the answer now, but that, and I was like, oh, fantastic. Absolutely.
Yeah, it goes along with the I can't remember who said this one, which is, in economics, we always refer to all other things equal, except they never are.
Very good. Very, very good. Now, Colin, I've got two more questions, and I'm going to ask you about your book choices, if you've got any. Now, if there was one thing you could change about the investing landscape, Colin, what would it be, please?
Oh, one thing to change. I think I'd like to see a much more international focus on providing services to the private investor. The CFD providers have actually done a pretty good job of this. But they're very much aimed at the professional, sophisticated, leveraged type of investor. I think for the general man in the street, so to speak, being able to invest in stocks cheaply in the UK market is relatively easy. Investing in European stocks is more difficult and more expensive. It shouldn't be. Investing in gilts is quite expensive, and generally the systems for holding the gilts are in a different place to the system for holding the stocks, which, yeah, shouldn't be the case. And if I wanted to hold, for want of a better, if I wanted to hold some Greek government bonds. Goodness knows why I'd want to do that, but they are yielding.
Exactly, I was going to ask that.
They're yielding just shy of 8%, which, given where a harmonised index of consumer prices in the eurozone is, actually looks quite compelling. But you know, it's really difficult, and you know, these are simple. They're simple securities that are listed. There's no reason with the technologies we have today why you shouldn't be able to invest in all of those, and also corporate bonds and you know, a range of other instruments. And you know, if I wanted to buy you know, Vietnamese stocks, well, you know, they have a system there. It just isn't hooked up. And part of that you know, is structural, but you know, part of it is just inertia on the part of the regulators. They've spent an awful lot of time on a lot of things which they probably shouldn't. And making the markets more efficient and more readily available to the retail investor, I think, is something that really you know, needs to be worked on. And I'd like to, you know, if I was in charge, I'd want to change that.
Okay, thank you for that. Colin, if you were starting out today in investing, what would you do that you had not considered or unable to do back then in the 80s?
Well, there's so many more things that you can do today in terms of ways to invest and sort of instruments. I mean, back in the 80s, there were investment trusts, there were unit trusts. The investment trusts have been around since the 19th century, but the sort of the range of options is much greater today. The ability to invest in foreign exchange, if that really is an investment, people still argue about whether it's an asset class. Back in the 80s there were futures and those were on regulated exchanges. Now there are CFDs on ETFs, on commodities, making the sort of the range of possibilities much greater. You know, the advent of CFDs and spread betting has kind of, I remember saying when I was working in that area back in the late 1990s that this really empowered the private investor to run his own hedge fund. And I stick to that view. The range of products that are available to them, I think, is still limited. I'd like to have the ability to trade interest rate swaps in my CFD account, but you know, I'm probably in the minority there. There's a peculiarity between the fact that beyond 10 years in the US, interest rate swaps are trading at a lower yield than the requisite treasury bonds. There's something really wrong with that relationship, and I haven't got to the bottom of it. I'll be writing about it when I have. Those are the sort of things.
Okay, Colin, thank you for that. I wanted to close, really, because as you will know, having listened to some of my other Conker's Corner podcasts, is that I'm a great lover of books. And believe in continual learning for all, for investing and in life in general. I just wanted to know if there was any books that you would recommend for our novice and our experienced investors, please.
In general, I think the most important thing to do is to read history. I think it was Mark Twain who said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. My goodness, that man was full of good quotes. And there are lessons from each period in history which come back in different forms and different ways. I recently read Anthony Beevor's The Battle for Spain, to look at how the Spanish Civil War developed and descended into chaos, which was it was quite fascinating to see the sort of polarization of politics and there are some eerie sort of echoes with what we're seeing in Europe today. One of the things that really stood out was, I imagine that many people who believe in free markets are of a slightly libertarian view. If you take libertarianism to its sort of ultimate conclusion, it's looking decidedly like anarchism. Not that, you know, classical anarchism is as bad as it gets credit for. But it was interesting to note that, you know, there was a very strong sort of anarchist tendency in the start of the sort of Republican side in the Civil War, but they didn't want to hold any positions of authority because it was at odds with their philosophy, which of course meant they got marginalized by the communists. And that was a kind of a fascinating insight to me. You can't change the world without having power, and, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So, and that's just one example. A good read, a long read, a book which, you know, is perhaps lighter reading, although it's a very long book. I do enjoy, because it's a good thriller and well written, is Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which gives you some a really different kind of view on things. And there'll be people who will be writing in and complaining as soon as I've said that. But, you know, it surprised me. I read that quite recently. I wonder what I would have made of it when I was 20.
Indeed, yeah.
Those are two. Inside the House of Money is a good book. Written by Stephen Drobny. It's interviews with successive hedge fund managers, but perhaps in a slightly more thoughtful way than I'm probably doing Jack Schwager a disservice saying more thoughtful way than Market Wizards. Mike Covell's Trend Following.
Yes, I know that.
He has some fascinating interviews with, I think, probably the unsung heroes of the investment world. One of them who I've always had a great respect for is Larry Hite, who set up the Mint Fund for Man Group.
Yeah.
I was at a conference where he got up and made this fabulous speech. And he said, this was a conference of managed futures managers. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, none of you are here today because your trading ability is in any doubt. But he said, given that most of you are systematic traders, this may sound odd, but he said, you need to be comfortable with the way you trade, emotionally comfortable. He said, I'll give you an example. He said, I'm an admirer of Warren Buffett. So he said, so a little while ago, I sat down and I went through all the SEC filings of Berkshire Hathaway. And at the end of the process, he said, from a systematic point of view, I was able to understand how Warren makes his money. He said, I was also able to realize that I would never be able to make money the way he does. And what he meant was, Buffett tends to buy as the market's going down. He has a view. It doesn't upset him to be averaging into a losing trade because he's looking to hold it for a very long period of time, and he's a contrarian style of investor quite often. Though with Apple the last year, you might say he's buying on a rising market. Maybe he's learned something from Larry Hite, because Larry Hite
indeed,
is
yes.
To follow the trend. He likes to see the momentum going up. You know what CTAs say is, we buy higher highs and sell lower lows. And people normally stop and say, hey, what? Haven't you got that the wrong way around? But that's actually what they do. So Trend Following by Mike Covell is a great book. And I think, you know, armed with Inside the House of Money and Trend Following, you'll probably have a pretty good idea about how some of the smartest people in the world make their money.
No, that's some exceptional choices you've made there, Colin. Thank you for that. I will ensure that our listeners have a view of those as well. Colin, I'm going to wrap here because I'm conscious that I've had you on the phone for some time. We'll have to meet up in London at some point and carry on this conversation. I want to thank you ever so much for joining me on Conker's Corner. It's been an absolute pleasure and a treat for myself, and I hope my listeners will enjoy it as much as I have.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on the programme, and thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you ever so much, Colin. I will speak to you soon, chap, and I look forward to speaking with you regarding a show we might be doing in London at some point later in the year.
That's fantastic.
Thank you ever so much, Colin. Take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Bye.